So the Dhamma for today is the Anantariya Kamma. These are five unique actions that have no possibility for mitigation. Nothing can get between them and their results. And that's what Anantariya means, with nothing in between them. And this is significant, to understand how significant it is, it's good to understand the nature of kamma in the Buddha's teaching. Kamma is something that normally you can't determine the results of, not precisely. Only a Buddha can understand what causes lead to what results. This isn't because kamma brings random results. The results are actually quite fixed. It's just that the results are complicated, incredibly complicated, just as with physical systems, the interactions are incredibly complicated. Kamma most of the time has results that are unpredictable by ordinary people. As we learn in the teaching on kamma, there are many types of kamma and they bring many types of results. For example, in ordinary cases, kamma can bring result in this life, it can bring result in the next life, it can bring result in some future life. It means a kamma, some ethical action you perform here and now might not bring result for many lifetimes to come. There's also interactions between kamma. For example, some kamma is simple, it brings about a result. But other times, one kamma will strengthen another kamma. You do one deed and other deeds that you've performed make the results of that action bring stronger results. For example, if you have a very good reputation, then good deeds that you do might be amplified. Conversely, bad deeds might also be amplified if people expect more from you, for example, because of things you've done. And on the other hand, if people are suspicious of you already the second time you do something, right, it can be the results can be amplified, the punishment and so on. Likewise, some deeds might counteract the deeds of others. So one deed canceling out another. You've done something bad, and then you do something good, and because of the bad thing you've done, you don't get any good result from the good deeds, for example. It cancels it out, or likewise can weaken. Sometimes one good deed will weaken the strength of the results of a bad deed and that sort of thing, meaning it's just very complicated, and so results are hard to determine. The Buddha pointed out that sometimes a person might do a terrible, terrible deed and still end up going to heaven, for example, or someone might do a very insignificant bad deed and go to hell as a result. The other reason for this is that it's very much associated with the mind. It's not so much in the deeds. It's not as though there's some judge trying to work out whether you've done a terrible deed or just a bad deed. The terrible or the bad or the weight of the kamma is very much determined by the state of mind, when you perform the deed, after you perform the deed, and so on. Nonetheless, kamma has results, and the results, as I said, are fixed in the sense that good deeds bring good results. They can't not bring good results. Bad deeds bring bad results, and they can't not bring bad results of some sort. A bad deed cannot bring about good results, and a good deed cannot bring about bad results. And of course, they can fail to bring about results, or the results can be mitigated, or that sort of thing. But that's another story. Another thing to talk about in terms of kamma is, in order to understand about these five kammas that are without mitigation, that lead immediately to their results, is to discuss how one comes to understand kamma. Because before I talk about these, it might seem like this is something you take as an article of faith. And to some extent, it really is something people take as an article of faith. We know not to do certain things like kill. We know not to kill, and we learn this when we first approach Buddhism as an article of faith. In other words, we don't truly understand what is the terrible evil that associated with killing or stealing or cheating or lying or drugs and alcohol, but we take it on faith. We have heard that this is wrong, and we accept it conditionally as a prerequisite for the practice of meditation. However, the understanding of kamma is not something that we need to take as an article of faith indefinitely. It is in fact an important part of the fundamentals or the foundation of meditation practice. In other words, at the very beginning of meditation practice, one begins to understand the nature of kamma. It's in fact the second stage of insight knowledge. So as one begins to practice mindfulness meditation, one begins to see the nature of nama and rupa. So one sees that rupa is one thing, nama is another thing. They see them arising and ceasing, seeing them as distinct and see them as momentary and that sort of thing. So the first stage of knowledge is seeing body and mind and being able to distinguish them from each other. So not thinking that we are one being or that this is me, this is I, but rather understanding us to be made up of moments of experience, that the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body and the mind, moments of experience that are made up of nama and rupa, or physical and mental components. But the second stage of knowledge is when you start to see how nama and rupa, the physical and the mental, work together in terms of cause and effect. So some of this is quite banal. You see that when you want to stand up, then there's standing up. And that's not necessarily karmic, but it is cause and effect. The only reason you stand up is because you want to stand up. But likewise, the only reason you do a bad deed is because of some mental impulse, some greed, some anger, some delusion. And the only reason you do a good deed is because of the opposite, a mind that is pure, free from greed, free from anger, free from delusion, that has clarity and wisdom and good intentions, kindness and compassion and so on. And this is something you see directly through the practice of mindfulness. It's not something you take on faith. And for this reason, the commentaries point out that this stage of knowledge is quite a distinction, that someone who has attained this is actually called a chula sotapanna, someone who in the next life will not be born in a bad state because they have come to see for themselves the importance and the efficacy of mental volition, greed and anger and delusion, having necessary results that are unavoidable. It's not something you can argue your way out of. There is no way to avoid the consequences. That bad deeds lead to bad results and good leads to good results. So that having been said, let's talk about these very exceptional cases that are, it's not a deep teaching and it's not something that I have to spend a lot of time on, but it is interesting in the context of karma that there are certain karmas that are so weighty that they cannot be mitigated. They cannot be nullified, they cannot be avoided. And you might think, well, could there not be an exception for someone who becomes enlightened? But these five kammas, these five deeds, forbid someone. They prevent, they block someone's ability to become enlightened. Furthermore, they block someone's ability even to go to heaven or even to be reborn as a human being. It is said that anyone who performs one of these five actions is immediately, at the moment of death, at the death in this life, is without exception sent straight to hell. So these are not just weighty, but they're five bad weighty kammas. The first is killing one's mother. The second is killing one's father. The third is killing an arahant, an enlightened being. The fourth is harming a Buddha, literally causing the blood to well, it's something like causing blood to rise, bruising a Buddha, basically. Anything that is in a minor harm to a Buddha. And number five, causing a schism in the Bhikkhu Sangha. These five, the Buddha said, are anantariya kamma. They are the most terrible of deeds that one could possibly perform. Killing one's mother and one's father, the point here is that we have such a strong connection with them and there is no one else who has such good karma towards us, generally speaking. There are cases, of course, where parents were not so good to their children, where they may have not been supportive or kind or helpful towards their children. And so there are cases where one might not see the distinction here. However, even if there is no sense of gratitude for the goodness of one's parents, there is still the incredibly close connection that we have to them. And as a result, the incredibly strong emotions surrounding our actions towards them, either good or bad. Even if our parents were terrible towards us, that terrible karma evokes in the children such a strong response as to want to kill or harm them on a level that is unlike any other sort of evil act performed towards a stranger or even a friend or an enemy. An evil deed performed towards one's parents is necessarily of such strength that causes great harm to one's mind. I mean, especially for ordinary situations where one's parents were supportive, where they carried the child in the womb for 9 months, enduring such hardships for the benefit of the child, and then after birth, caring for them and helping them when they were helpless for so many years. This is the kind of thing that Buddhists also take on faith. We take it as a article of religious belief that one should care for one's parents, and so it seems like something that one should always take on faith, or one has to always take on faith. But in fact, here especially, it's quite common for meditators in the early stages of their practice, as they start to enter into the second, the third stage of knowledge, to start to appreciate and realize the consequences of the deeds that they have performed in the past, especially towards people like their parents. It can become quite difficult for them to continue practice as they start to feel anguish over how they may have poorly treated their parents in their past, or as they feel such love towards their parents and a realization of the strong bond that they have towards their parents, wanting to go home, wanting to see their parents, that sort of thing. It's a common experience for meditators to really viscerally feel the connection that one has with one's parents. It's just such a strong bond for most people, whether it be a positive or a negative thing, that it's easy to see how there is there's karma on a different level anytime we harm or engage with our parents. And likewise, anytime we help or support our parents, we have done a thing that is something unlike anything else we might do to help other people. Helping one's parents is something that is on a whole other level because of how close our connection is and how great is our bond towards them, and how great has their kindness been towards us, usually, for the most part. The third, killing an arahant, is a little easier to appreciate because of how pure and how special an arahant is. I mean, maybe hard to appreciate if you've never met anyone who might be enlightened or even on one of the stages of enlightenment, but as you start to engage in Buddhist culture and Buddhist society, you begin to appreciate how incredible even someone who is a sotapanna, let alone someone who has attained anagami or arahant. And so if anyone is to harm an arahant, it is such a unfathomable action, let alone to actually kill, cause their death purposefully. This is obviously something that, as Buddhists, we have no trouble understanding as being the worst of the worst. I don't think there's any sense that a person engaged in meditation practice would ever be guilty of this sort of crime, but it's part of the Buddhist teaching, and it's interesting and important to understand. The fourth is harming a Buddha. Now, obviously, this can't happen, but just to understand that it's not possible to kill a Buddha. Again, this is one of those things that even though anything seems possible, there are certain laws and certain rules. They're not exactly laws and rules, it's just the weight of the action. So just like any of these five, you might think, well, couldn't there be some way? Because anything's possible, right? How can we be sure that you would go straight to hell? It's too powerful. It's too strong to allow for anything else. It's not that there's actually a law, it's that the power and the strength of the deed is beyond anything, any force in the universe. There's no force in the universe that could change the mind enough to free one from the consequences of the action. And likewise, there's no force in the universe that could overpower the greatness, the goodness, the purification, the perfection of the Buddha to kill him. However, it is possible to harm the Buddha, as we see in the stories. There was a man, the Buddha's cousin, Devadatta, who actually did succeed in harming the Buddha, causing his foot to bleed or be bruised or something. And as a result, he needed care from a physician. And the fifth is a schism in the Sangha. So the schism in the Sangha is a testament to the greatness that the Buddha attributed to the Sangha and the crucial nature of the Sangha. A Sangha is a group of monks, a group of ordained bhikkhus who have organized in such a way that they are keeping the rules that the Buddha passed on and reciting the rules that the Buddha passed on. It's at least four monks or more than four monks. Any community that has at least four monks, the Buddha gave the authority to recite the Patimokkha and to do various other activities of the Sangha. So a schism of the Sangha is where one, rather than take one's grievances to the Sangha and work them out as a community, works instead to separate the Sangha and divide the Sangha. And this might seem... I would say it's more common than one might think, and this one is more easy to get caught up in and therefore more dangerous, because one might think that suppose one found or felt that another monk in the community was acting inappropriately, one might then go to tell other monks, you know, this monk is acting inappropriately, you shouldn't associate with him. But that is not the right way to do things. I mean, that, because everyone has their own idea of what's right and wrong, that is what, of course, causes schisms and causes harm and destroys the Sangha, which, again, the Buddha said is of such great importance, because a Sangha that's in harmony brings together the community, as we can see in any monastery that we've been to. It doesn't affect only the monks, it affects anyone who wants to come to practice in the monastery. When there is disharmony and disagreement of the Dhamma, disagreement over the Vinaya. And the right way to approach these things is to have a meeting of the Sangha and to talk about the problems and to work them out. And for this, the Buddha laid down rules and laid down ways and means of undertaking this. So a caution to us as monastics and a reminder that, to be honest, when we have problems, even when someone has wrong views or wrong beliefs, it really would be best if we brought them up and talked about them as a Sangha and came to a decision about what this meant for the community. It would be wrong to try and divide people and tell people to break apart. And The schism succeeds when one succeeds in convincing monks, at least it would be one other monk or enough monks so that there is enough for two sanghas or not enough for one sangha, I'm not sure, to hold the Patimokkha. So to hold the Patimokkha, to have the Uposatha, this bi-weekly meeting where the monks get together and reaffirm their commitment to the monastic training, requires at least four monks. So if you break apart the Sangha, such that the Sangha can no longer perform the Patimokkha or has determined that they will no longer hold it together. In other words, they say, we are no longer in communion, we're no longer a community with you, and so they break apart into two groups. This is called a schism of the Sangha, where they refuse to recite the Patimokkha, they refuse to do Sangha Kamma together, to do the procedures and the activities of the Sangha together. These five, the Buddha pointed out, are of such weighty nature, they're called Garu Kamma. So where this fits in is the other type, there's another set of classification of Kamma, and that's how it brings about fruit at the moment of death. And so at the moment of death, there are many ways in which rebirth comes about. One is something that you've done often. So if throughout your life you were a murderer or a thief or something you did often and was habitual towards you, for you, that sort of thing is what leads to rebirth, most likely, in most cases. Likewise, if you're a person who practices samatha meditation and enters into jhana quite often, it's quite likely that when you die, you will enter into a state of jhana and go to the Brahma world, because that is your habit. Likewise, if someone is kind and generous, this is the kind of habit that will give its fruit at the moment of death. This is called achinna kamma or bahula kamma or something, kamma that you have done often. So this is most likely. And the second one, if there's nothing like that, there's what we call asana kamma, where at the moment of death, it may not have been habitual, but at the moment of death, something happens. Maybe you're in an accident, or maybe you're in a fight, and you're murdered or you're killed, and there's some kamma, something that goes on in your mind, some reaction, some greed, some anger, some delusion. At the moment of death, you perform some kamma. That can be strong enough to override any other kamma or any other decision and lead to rebirth. And if there's nothing like that happening, if you die peacefully, and you don't have any strong habits, then sometimes there's what is called katta kamma or something, kamma that you have just performed. It means any kamma, something you did in your life might come to you. You know how they say your life flashes before your eyes when you die? Well, something might grab your attention, something that you did that might grab your attention. We see this in meditation. If you haven't practiced mindfulness meditation, you've heard perhaps about this idea of when you die, your whole life flashes, so you remember everything that you did. And it's not true that you remember everything, but you'll remember many things. But we can see how this is possible, or that this is true when you practice mindfulness meditation, because this happens over a longer scale. As you have this focus, the same sort of focus you would have when you die, you start to bring up things that you thought you'd forgotten about. In the practice of mindfulness, you might remember when you were a child, things that you'd forgotten. You'll remember the sequence of events throughout your life, things that you did, things that happened to you, things that you thought you'd let go of and realized you're still attached to, this sort of thing. So when you die, this happens, and it can happen, and it may very well be that something, it will have to be that something eventually you cling to, and that leads you to be reborn in relation to that kamma. However, none of these have any effect if there is this, what we call the garu kamma, that is hanging over you. If you have performed in this life any one of these five garu kamma, the anantariya kamma, then there is no mitigating. None of these others can possibly be strong enough to have any effect. They're all completely overwhelmed by the guilt and the feeling of terrible evil in the mind that is burdened by these five, what we call anantariya kamma. So, the lesson that we take away is, first of all, never perform any one of these five. Be very careful about schisms of the Sangha. It's something that we should be perhaps a little more careful about than we are. Obviously, careful with your parents. Now, for monastics, it's not such a deal, but it can happen that your parents are on life support and or your parents are critically ill and you decide to make some decision to end their life. There are mitigating factors here as far as letting someone die peacefully, if they don't want to continue to take life-saving medication. If they decide to do that, then it's not evil to allow them to do that. However, there's a strong encouragement encourage people to commit such, to let go of life. Though it wouldn't be considered murder. Allowing someone to die or encouraging someone to die is not great because of the importance of being a human being and the danger of allowing your aversion towards suffering determine your actions. So for example, if you're in great pain and you want to die and you ask people to let you die, you're going to die with a state of great aversion in your mind, and it's not going to be a very wholesome or beneficial way to leave this world. Whereas if you're encouraged to bear with it, it can happen that you overcome the sickness, and there are cases where people are then able to go on to live productive lives, and actually more productive lives, because they've gone through something of great difficulty. It builds character, it creates strength and gives you confidence in your ability to face suffering, if you can do it mindfully. So just a caution that even allowing people to die is not generally the best decision. I mean, of course, you can't forbid people not to die, but we should be careful about encouraging people or agreeing with people that they should just go and free themselves from suffering, because as we know, you don't get free from suffering just because you die. Death is not the end of suffering, especially if you die with a polluted mind, a mind full of aversion and sadness and fear and suffering and so on. Obviously, be careful around enlightened beings. Putting aside the idea of killing an arahant, we should be careful around meditators, and we should be conscientious and thoughtful that even though they may have their own challenges and their own problems, even though we might not like them or have some enmity towards them, we should treat them like an open flame that could very much burn us if we mess with it. Enlightened beings are of such purity that if a person is practicing meditation, we should be conscious that they may very well be a person who is of great merit and great benefit to the world, and us harming them is never going to be of any good to us or to the world or to that being as well. And finally, be careful of the Sangha. We should honor the Sangha. We should honor the importance of the Sangha, not consider ourselves to be above the decision and the determinations made by the Sangha. We should honor it and revere it and protect it. Protect the Sangha and try to always welcome monks who are of good character, who have right view and who have right ethics and good behavior. We should welcome them and appreciate them and work to create communal harmony. So that's the first lesson. The second lesson, though, is an appreciation that it's only these five that are anantariya kamma, meaning as rare as these might be, they do point out something else important to us, that any other deed that you might perform, theoretically, you have the capacity to overcome, and theoretically is not a absolute barrier to being reborn as a human being, to going to heaven, or even to becoming enlightened. And this can often worry meditators for no good reason, where they have done something that they regret in the past, even something terrible like murder, or often it would be killing animals or that sort of thing, and feel like maybe they were a thief, or maybe they were a drug addict, or that sort of thing, and feel like it's impossible for them to ever become enlightened. And that is never going to be true unless they cross this line. It's likely, of course, that people who commit bad deeds, and as I've said, do it habitually, that's the sort of thing that when you die, that's likely to bring fruit. However, it's certainly the case that it can all be mitigated and even nullified through the practice of mindfulness. There is much that can be undone. Nullified through the opposing power of mindfulness and the opposing power of wisdom, the clarity of mind that comes and sees that those things that you've done were wrong, and the appreciation that those deeds are done out of greed, out of anger, out of delusion, for the detriment to oneself and others. So this should also bring us confidence and remind us that it's never too late. And the third lesson, related to that, in fact, is that even someone who performs these terrible, terrible actions is not doomed. Because yes, they are doomed to go to hell. There's no question. However, even someone who is reborn in a place as horrible as that is not doomed forever. Even that comes to an end. Just as this comes to an end, every life, every birth, every experience comes to an end. There's no arisen experience that lasts forever. So a final lesson is just that we're never doomed, and we should never feel like we're useless or hopeless, no matter what we've done, no matter who we are. And there's always ways that we can strive to be good and beneficial to ourselves and to others. We have the story of Ajatasattu, who who was the son of King Bimbisara, and Bimbisara was a Sotapanna. He was one of the first major disciples of the Buddha. And his son got in with the wrong people, became friends with Devadatta, who, as I said, tried to kill the Buddha on multiple occasions. But he told Ajatasattu to try and kill his father, and Ajatasattu spent so much time trying to kill his father and eventually succeeded, just barely succeeded, realized at the last moment that it was a horrible thing for him to do, but was too late, and in fact reached his father's side after his father had just passed away from starving his father to death. Which was a horrible, horrible action that has no excuse and allows for no apology. However, he then spent the rest of his life trying to make amends. He listened to the Buddha's teaching, he was faithfully ministering to the Buddha, he was the sponsor for the first Buddhist council after the Buddha passed away. He was instrumental in helping to preserve and spread Buddhism after that time when he killed his father. But none of that freed him from the potential of going to hell. However, the story goes that he's eventually going to be reborn, I think, as a Pacheka Buddha. He eventually will become fully enlightened. The prophecy goes that eventually he will become free from suffering as a result of his good deeds. It's just that there was such a powerful, weighty, bad karma that, again, allowed for no antariya. So it was anantariya. But still not without hope. Even Devadatta is said to be eventually going to be reborn. The Buddha gave prophecy that he will eventually become free from hell. And because actually at the last moment Devadatta realized how wrong he was, just before he passed away, he realized that, and he tried to take refuge in the Buddha, but it was too late. So the moral is that it's never too late, and there is always hope. And certainly for us who have done good deeds and bad deeds, we always have the potential to free ourselves. We always have the potential here and now. We shouldn't get bogged down by things we've done in the past. We should try our best to focus on the present for a future that will be better and more pure. All we can affect is the present. If we get caught up in the past, worried about the future, well, we'll never be able to see clearly because we'll never be focused on the reality that's right in front of us. So, an important teaching, something that has to be mentioned. Again, there's not a lot to say about the five Anantariya Kamma themselves, just don't do them. But the broader topic of Kamma and cause and effect and determinism and that sort of thing is interesting. To understand that we do have a path forward no matter what might come. That there always is a path forward as long as we someday, some moment, take this moment and don't let this moment pass us by. So that's the Dhamma for today.